Irving Picard is a man in search of ill-gotten gains. Picard is the lawyer from the firm of Baker & Hostetler, who is the court-appointed trustee in the biggest financial swindle of all time, the Bernard Madoff case. His task is to recover or claw back money from those who came out winners in the Madoff Ponzi scheme and dole out some compensation to the many losers. Mr. Picard joins us now from Oxon Hill, Maryland, where he's attending a meeting of the Association of Certified Fraud Examiners. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
And in your most recent report to the bankruptcy court, you wrote that you've recovered about $1.5 billion before Madoff's investment business collapsed. It claimed accounts totaling about $65 billion, perhaps an inflated number. Have you been able to determine just how much money investors had with Madoff?
We've been using as a working number somewhere between $18 and $20 billion that had been deposited when the doors closed on December 11, 2008.
And how much of that money do you reasonably hope to recover?
I learned a long time ago that I don't speculate on those things. My aim is to collect as much as possible. I'm hopeful that we can return upwards of 50 cents or even more on the dollar to people.
I'd like to try to get a sense of which investors are considered winners here, or which investors you should go after. We all understand that, say, very close associates or relatives of Mr. Madoff's who made a lot of money may possibly have been in on the swindle or should have known. Some big investors who ran feeder funds perhaps should have known. But why should someone who invested with Madoff in good faith, made some money, paid taxes on it, and is now, say, living in retirement on those earnings, why should that person's assets be clawed back?
The net winners are people who received fictitious profits. So they got more than they had deposited. And the only way that they could have gotten that money is that that money was taken from people who have lost money, who haven't been paid back in full what they deposited. And the bankruptcy code provides a mechanism for a bankruptcy trustee, it's called avoidance actions, to get back some of those funds to redistribute them to the people who lost money. We're talking here about fictitious profits and somebody being paid with other people's money.
So if I had put $50,000 in with Madoff 15 years ago, and I looked at my eye-popping sums every time when I got a statement from him, what I would be compensated, the amount I would be compensated to today would be the $50,000.
If you hadn't taken out any other money, that is correct.
How cooperative are you finding the winners whom you've been trying to reclaim money from?
Well, we've sent out hundreds of letters, and we've gotten very few of any responses.
The longer you do this and the more you learn about Madoff's investment business, are you more impressed with how easy it was for one to believe in his successes as an investor, or are you more incredulous that one could have not seen through the returns that
I would say that I'm more incredulous.
More incredulous. People should have known, seeing what they were.
Well, I think there were lots of what us lawyers call red flags that people should have picked up on, and that's why we think that many of these people, especially ones that we've already sued, are in a category of should have known.
We report on your doings often here, and it's good to talk to you at last. But I just wonder, when we speak of Irving Picard trustee, is there an entire a department of Baker and Hostetler? Do you have a huge staff that's working on this? How many people are actually working on it?
Well, it depends on what the issue is and, quite frankly, the day or the week. We have lots of issues. We have lots of people working on this case. I have forensic consultants, investigators. This is a far-reaching case. This is a case that involves issues not just in the United States, but issues we're involved in 12 to 15 foreign countries. I have lawyers in some of the foreign countries. We've brought litigation in some of the foreign countries. We've been able to freeze something like $200 million in Gibraltar and British Virgin Islands, the Caymans, and a couple of other places. This isn't just a little case or a case that's solely situated in the Southern District of New York.
Is this the balance of your career, being a Madoff trustee?
It very well could be.
Well, we hope you'll talk to us again about it at some point.
It'd be my pleasure.
Irving Picard, the trustee in the Madoff bankruptcy, thank you very much for talking with us.
My pleasure.
This is NPR. New York City opened a new playground today. It's called the Imagination Playground, and it's made up of hundreds of giant blue foam tinker toys. This got our Planet Money team thinking during an economic downturn, why is New York suddenly getting creative? NPR's Robert Smith reports.
Kids today, they don't know how good they got it. This afternoon, Aja Chelebi wasn't lined up waiting for some rusty swing. She was collecting these bright blue blocks, some as big as she is, and making...
I'm not exactly sure. I'm just going to try to build stuff and then see what happens.
And then whatever it looks like, that's what it is, right?
Yeah.
There is no shortage of possibilities here.
Because you can make your own playground. You can make your own kind of stuff, and you don't have to follow all the stuff that other people make.
It was so much fun that the kids were ignoring the mayor of New York City on the other end of the playground, cutting the ribbon and bragging about the $7.5 million price tag.
You betcha.
The Imagination Playground began, as do many things in New York City, with a cranky architect. David Rockwell has two young kids. He lives in Lower Manhattan. And as he watched them play on the same set of swings and monkey bars, he thought there must be a better way.
And I was obsessed with trying to figure it out.
Turns out there is a theory of playgrounds that's been around for decades. Just get the big structures out of the way and let kids be kids. So Rockwell designed the park as a large figure eight with sand, water, pulleys, and those blue blocks.
And as you'll see, there's hundreds of movable objects. Nothing is tied down, and the options are endless.
It would be easy to dismiss the new Imagination Playground as a boutique project. But during a brutal recession, the city of New York has opened one sparkling new playground after another. And this is where the economics question comes in. Since when did playgrounds become the priority during a downturn? The answer lies in the concept of risk and reward. Turns out, for 100 years, playgrounds contained few rewards because...
playgrounds are all about avoiding risk.
Susan Solomon is an architectural historian who wrote the book American Playgrounds, Revitalizing Community Space. Even from the beginning, playgrounds were literally about playing it safe. Designed in the early 1900s to keep poor immigrant children from getting hurt in the street or drowning in the river, and you would have recognized those designs.
Because by then, you're already dealing with the sandbox, the slide, the seesaw.
And New York City was happy to clone those early playgrounds during the 1930s. Cheap, cookie-cutter designs, easy to maintain, easy to clean. Solomon says there were a few playground innovators in the 1960s, like Richard Dattner. But when she asked him why he quit, he told Solomon,
I don't want someone whose kid breaks her arm to sue me for all I'm worth.
The threat of lawsuits became this huge disincentive for innovation. Even the old stuff disappeared. The seesaw, the spinning merry-go-rounds. Why take a chance? There was no upside to innovation. Which brings us back to the Imagination Playground. There are still plenty of lawyers and lawsuits around. What changed? Well, first of all, New York did. The middle class started to stay in the city to raise their families, and the city discovered something. Adrian Benepe, the parks commissioner, says they discovered that parks do have an upside. They could be built as economic development tools.
And when you do that, that's when people say, you know, I'm going to stay in this neighborhood. I'm going to move to that neighborhood. I'm going to invest. I'm going to locate. I'm going to keep my business here or expand my business.
The Innovation Playground was paid for in part by economic development money to bring businesses back to Lower Manhattan after 9/11. The real measure of success won't just be in the delight of the children. It will be if we hear squeals of laughter from business owners and condo developers who suddenly have a unique kid-packed amenity to help them sell. Robert Smith, NPR News, New York.
Support for Planet Money comes from Ally Bank, committed to customer service. At allybank.com, visitors can chat online with a customer care associate 24/7.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. Electronic readers are no longer a high-tech novelty. They're challenging traditional publishing and have thrust the entire industry into a revolution. All sides, publishers, agents, retailers, are scrambling to position themselves for the moment when digital books take over once and for all. As NPR's Lynn Neary reports, some recent developments illustrate just how ugly the fight may be.
There was a time when e-books seemed to be the future in publishing. That time is over. The future is now.
Well, certainly the e-book market is exploding.
Tom Allen, CEO of the Association of American Publishers. The latest evidence of the importance of e-books to publishing was Amazon's recent announcement that its sales of e-books have overtaken sales of hardcovers. And Allen's organization reports that e-book sales have increased more than 200% this year. All this is taking place as issues such as who owns the rights to books published before the advent of digital publishing remain unresolved. Back then, says Allen, publishers didn't explicitly include e-books in their contracts with authors.
Now they're engaged in disputes over whether the language in the contracts covers e-books or not.
That question led to a still simmering dispute between one of the major publishing houses, Random House, and the powerful Wiley Literary Agency. Wiley established its own publishing brand and signed an exclusive deal with Amazon to sell digital versions of some bestsellers like Lolita and The Invisible Man that came out before electronic books existed.
When an agent becomes a publisher, that is sort of contradictory.
Best-selling author Scott Turow is president of the Authors Guild. Turow says the Guild is concerned that Wiley may have a conflict of interest in taking on the role of both publisher and agent. But it is especially critical of Wiley for signing an exclusive deal with Amazon, which dominates the digital book market in both electronic readers and e-books. But the Guild is also troubled by the way Random House responded. The publishing company said it wouldn't do business with any English-language authors represented by Wiley until the dispute is resolved. That, says Turow, hurts no one but the writers.
I think the most amusing part of it is that we're going to beat up on those poor authors who have Andrew Wiley as their agent, but we're not going to take anything out on the behemoth Amazon. In other words, we're going to walk down the beach and kick some sand in the face of the 99-pound weakling.
Writers are understandably worried about royalties. Amazon angered the publishing industry when it set the price of an e-book at $9.99, much lower than the cost of a hardcover. Turow says that's already had a negative effect on compensation for writers. In addition, writers want more than the 25% royalty which the major houses have been offering for digital rights. But Jane Friedman, former CEO of HarperCollins, who co-founded the digital publishing company Open Road, says the issue of royalties can't be resolved until the question of who owns the rights to older books is settled.
I think this is probably the most important issue in this whole new world of digital publishing.
Friedman's company had its own run-in with Random House over the works of the late William Styron. Random House challenged Open Road's right to publish Styron's books digitally. Eventually, Random House said it would make an exception for Styron. Friedman says her company believes that digital rights belong to the writer or their estate unless a contract explicitly states otherwise. And she says they want the rights question resolved before they take on a book.
In other words, if someone comes to us and says there is some confusion in a contract, we won't even talk to that representative. We will only talk where the content provider says we have the rights.
One other question raised by the standoff between Random House and the Wiley Agency: if a literary agency can become a publisher, then what's to stop Amazon or Apple or Google or any other digital behemoth, as Scott Turow calls them, from doing the same thing?
The concern is that they will step up, take the cream, and make it impossible for other publishers to survive because they're going to take the titles where, you know, the most money is going to be made.
On a positive note, Turow points out e-books are encouraging people to buy more books, and no one is complaining about that. Lynn Neary, NPR News, Washington.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Michelle Norris. You can now crack the code on your iPhone to install whatever applications you want without Apple's permission. That's just one of the rulings issued by the U.S. Copyright Office yesterday. And while it's the ruling that's getting the most press because it applies to the most people, it's not the only significant decision the Copyright Office issued. Joining us to explain what happened and what this all means is NPR's Laura Seidel. Laura, first, why is the U.S. Copyright Office getting into how your iPhone works?
Well, every 3 years, the Copyright Office reviews something called the 1998 Digital Millennium Copyright Act, and they review it to make sure that it's not unduly restricting what they call fair use of material that's covered by copyright. So in the case of the iPhone, the Copyright Office was looking at the lock that Apple puts on the iPhone to restrict which applications consumers can install, and it decided that the lock restricts how consumers can use something they own.
Something they call jailbreaking.
That's right. They call it jailbreaking because it means you can break Apple's lock that essentially prevents you from putting applications that are not approved by Apple onto the phone. You know, normally Apple would say, if you break the lock, you're tampering with our software. And now you can break the lock. It's your phone. You bought it, right?
So if you want to break the lock and install something, give us an example of what you could now do with your iPhone that you couldn't do before.
A big one was Google Voice, and this is a program that lets users reroute phone calls and voicemail through Google's system for perks like cheaper international call rates. And this was something that Apple simply hadn't approved, and so you couldn't get it. Now you can break the phone, and you can get it. Although, I will say, Apple can say, you know what, we're not going to warranty your phone anymore. So some people may not be willing to risk that.
Now, the ruling, we've been talking about the iPhone, but the ruling does not just affect iPhones. It does affect other mobile devices, too. Is that correct?
Yes, it does. And in fact, one very important thing is you can now buy a phone. It has to be a used phone. And you can decide which carrier it goes on. Previously, if you bought a phone, you bought it from, you know, Sprint. And Sprint said, you know, or Verizon said, this phone has to be used on our network. Well, now it doesn't. You can say, all right, I bought a Verizon phone and I'm going to use it on Sprint.
What else did the Copyright Office rule on yesterday?
Well, very significantly, they ruled that documentary filmmakers, teachers, and students can crack the code on a DVD that would normally lock it and keep you from copying it. And they can take a section and use it in a documentary or in some kind of educational material. And previously, it had been illegal to do that. So say if you were making a documentary about the civil rights movement and you wanted to go back and take a little bit of footage from, you know, dogs attacking protesters. Well, now you can crack the code, you can take a little bit of that footage, and you can put it in your documentary and not have to worry about violating copyright law.
When you talk about cracking the encryption, that sounds like something that's incredibly difficult. Is that something that the average Joe could do, or do you need a good amount of expertise for this?
You need some expertise. And here's the funny thing. It's not clear whether or not the people who have that expertise and give you the skills to do it, they could be breaking the law still. So that's a little unclear.
One last question. If you do, say, have an iPhone and you want to go shopping and use something that was previously restricted, if you have to go back to iPhone update, you know, get one of those service updates that you need every 6 months or so, is at that point, does it revert to the old iPhone with the old locks?
That is a good point, and indeed it will. They can say, if you want to update your phone, you know, forget about it. You're going to lose the way you broke the lock. You're not going to be able to update your phone and put on the new software if you break the lock.
Laura, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
That's NPR's Laura Seidel. She covers technology and copyright issues.